is the publisher and has been tremendous help in getting the book accepted and general kind of management of the publication side of things. It was the wondrous Springer, with whom some of us have got long histories, who actually produced the book. But Rebecca is the Palgrave, the face of Palgrave. And as well as giving you that discount, 20% discount for everybody who's here.
Oh,
bless you. Can we have everyone on mute, please? Apart from people who are officially speaking. Thank you. And as many people on video as possible, because it's so nice to see people's faces. So there's the discount. And if you, we'll put it up again later, although we will be closing down chat when people are actually speaking in a planned way, because, and reopening chat later. The other thing I wanted to say was if you want a free copy of the book, then what you have to do is commit yourself to writing a review for a respectable journal. And then you get in touch with Palgrave and say, I'm going to review the book for such and such. And that's the way that review copies get distributed these days, which seems terribly sensible. So, yes, Tony, maths teaching does count as respectable, and that is why you were invited to this launch. You could do a review, okay? And ditto Jenny with RME. So, please get in touch with Palgrave and say that you're going to review it, and that would be wonderful. And then after that, it's over to you. You know, I can't twist your arm about the nature of the review. So what have I said? Now, welcome everybody. We've got people from all over England, other parts of the UK, and some places further afield, like South Africa and Calgary. And I think we have people from Australia as well, but I've been unable to monitor everybody. And we might have somebody from Hong Kong as well. We are recording this because the recording will then be sent to people who've been unable to come because of time zone difficulties. And I do want to thank you hugely, all of you who've come. And many people among the audience have contributed to the book, either by giving me access to their teaching, to their classrooms, or post-COVID lockdown, to conversations about their classrooms. Or also a team of critical readers that I assembled when I had a full draft of the book. I had a team of about 10, 12 critical readers who gave significantly of their time and yeah, efforts to help with the book. And what they said was really very, very useful. And many others of you are long-standing friends and colleagues, and some of you are relatively new friends and colleagues. So it's quite a mixture. I'm now going to introduce Brent Davis, who at 2:20 in the morning Calgary time has very kindly agreed to talk about the book, having read it a while back. And I'm going to hand over to Brent, and I suggest you all change to speak of you, and I'm sure I don't even have to tell you that. And Brent, you've got share screen on if you want it.
Gee, I should have thought about that. Alrighty. Well, let me just start by thanking Anne for this opportunity to speak in the middle of the night. It is a thrill to find a space to speak whenever Anne's in the room. I'm going to be speaking around the book. Yeah, Anne, that was a slice. Not about the book. I'll let Anne do the latter. And let me start with by speaking around the title, Care in the Mathematics Classroom. When I received the draft copy of the book, of course, my first question was, what could that possibly mean? I've sort of scripted myself, by the way. I'm going to try not to read, but just in case my half-asleep brain falls the rest asleep, I'm just going to follow the words on the screen. So, care in the mathematics classroom, what would that mean? That would be an easy question to answer if mathematics were included among the humanities, but as we all know, the teaching of mathematics, at least, fully belongs among the inhumanities. So, care in the mathematics classroom, whatever that is, has to be a steep hill to climb. So that thought was pressing down hard on me when I read Anne's book last summer about halfway through, it took me that long before something changed, before I started getting the hang of what care in the mathematics classroom might be. And I started to get traction when it called to mind a line from a movie, Sally Potter's 1990s on screen who's seen it, but it's sort of biopic. Filmmaker Sally Potter gets lessons from a world-class tango dancer named Pablo. And as these movies go, something resembling love starts to emerge. And as these things go, that love is a little bit fraught and tumultuous. And well into the movie, an insecure Pablo whines something like, I don't think he whines this, but it's something like this, "You don't love me." And Sally responds, "I do love you with my work." And for 20 years, that statement has really bugged me. When I saw it, it's okay, I kind of like that, and I don't. I immediately reframed it for myself, like, do I love my students with my work? And not love in the sense of profound affection, because let's face it, we're paid to do it. And not love in the sense of enduring commitment, because let's face it, we're on the clock. The relationship by definition is brief and bounded. So when I was reading Anne's book, something is somewhere in the middle of chapter 5, which is titled Care. 20 years of musing about the construct of loving my students with my work started to make sense to me. So I'm going to explain what I think happened and what I think the book is about by compressing my career into three moments that I'll call the pre-Anne decade, the aware of Anne decade, and the knowing Anne decade. So the pre-Anne decade, also known as the 1990s, did my PhD in the early 90s. Research was developed around understanding mathematics, mathematics teaching in terms of listening. Check it out on page 87 and page 88. Specifically, I'm guessing at the numbers. I interpreted listening as a kind of committed, engaged, attending to learners that involves not just making sense of the sense learners are making, but implicating yourself in that sense. So I finished that degree and that bit of research in 94, got a job. In the balance of the decade, I spent trying to do further work into teacher listening. And frustratingly, it went no further than my doctoral studies. Teacher after teacher I worked with, I came to the same conclusion that most really wanted to listen, but few really could. And the conclusion of the decade was that listening isn't an attitude or a commitment. It's a learned skill, and that rests on some significant knowledge, but I couldn't put my finger on what that knowledge is. So that was sort of the moment of meeting Anne, my aware of Anne decade, moment two in my career. I started reading her work in the early 2000s. And fortuitously and kind of sort of accidentally, I met her in 2003 in Australia. I was in Melbourne on business, different kind of business, and found out there was a conference happening in Geelong. So I dropped in because, of course, that I'd be able to write off a lot of my expenses. As coincidence would have it, Anne was keynoting, and we skipped out on a lot of sessions and chatted together. Is anyone from Australia on this? Because that might be a secret you didn't want revealed. Anne's is the only session from the conference that I actually remember, and it may be the only one I attended, but I was there the whole time. But she changed my world. It was the first presentation I'd ever heard that really, really offered something I was able to recognize as useful around two intertwining elements. First of all, the structure of mathematical ideas, and second, the dynamics of human cognition. In Anne's presentation, those weren't different things. And that was the first math ed presentation that I came onto that somehow learning about learning and learning about mathematics were inextricable. So I listened as hard as I could for how she was doing that, because I knew it would help to answer this quandary I was having about why can't I help teachers listen better? I came to the conclusion while she was speaking that I've been making two errors. First of all, I've been committing that sin of separating mathematics and learning in my own thinking, but I hadn't been paying near the attention that I should have been paying to the subtle elements that are knitted together inside every mathematics concept, that the mathematics was more complex and subtle than I imagined it had been. I've always been good at math. I've always been good at teaching math. And that was the fault. And in effect, my lack of caring. I needed to pay more attention to that. So Anne won't remember it, but it was at that conference during one of the block of sessions that we both skipped out of. One of the many. And she said something that prompted me to react with the line, "So you're saying that math teachers need to be experts who can think like novices." And I know that's true because I wrote it down, and I still have the little notebook that I wrote it down in. Like, I actually did do that with a date and with Anne's email address written in her own script. Yes, I got an autograph in the form of an email address. So I guess I was starstruck. Anyhow, I spent the rest of that decade working with groups of teachers to understand mathematics and to understand cognition at the same time. And it was a truly winning mix in my own career. I mentioned that I ended the previous decade with the realization that listening isn't just an attitude or a commitment, it's a learned skill. I ended that second decade with a much better sense of the sorts of formal knowledge that are knitted into that skill. It was my year of learning mathematics, but mathematics for teaching. So that takes us to moment three, which is my knowing Anne years, and that's been the last decade. I started hanging out with Anne and her husband, John, a little over 10 years ago in a big way. In a sort of mind if I come and visit for a few days sort of way. And somewhat oddly, they never said no. So I've kept coming. And I've also forced them to visit me several times. So over the past 10 years, in this knowing and decade, I've been part of a team of researchers and teachers and resource developers in a really well-funded project that's just run out of money. But we've all been working together to figure out how to make school mathematics more of a humanity than an inhumanity, to pick up where I started. We've called on Anne and John frequently for input and feedback and critique, and they've never turned us away or failed us, especially on the critique end of things. I think they probably wanted to turn us away a few times, but they're so kind. And I'm so persistent. So the project is called Math Minds. And if you really want to see it, check it out at structuringinquiry.com, structuringinquiry, all one word. The website houses information on a model of teaching that I'll describe in two short sentences. One, it offers a nuanced means of listening by helping teachers afford learners. Okay, I have to go to my line. Sorry, I have to read this one. Because I want to get this right. It offers a nuanced means of listening by helping teachers to afford learners structured access to what they need to make sense of mathematical concepts. Okay, I'm glad I wrote that down because my brain at this hour can't actually make sense of it, but it helps teachers listen. And the second short sentence is much shorter. It's a total ripoff of Anne's work. So that's my history with Anne so far. But as I mentioned at the start, I had this little epiphany when I was reading chapter 5 in Karen Mathematics at education with the realization that the teaching is listening that I've been studying for 30 years was still missing something, and that Anne had put her finger on that missing element in her treatment of care. It's not just knowing the mathematics, it's about caring for the mathematics. And it's not just making sense of learners, it's about caring for the for their learning. And I think, well, I won't say, I think I had that right, but I'll let you know after we hear Anne speak. I'll suppress the temptation to say more about that because I think she might want to. So Anne's right on time in terms of the way I structure my life by the decade. It's the start of a new decade. So that means the start of a new moment in our relationship. So following on the pre-Anne decade of the 1990s and the aware of Anne decade that started with the new millennium and the knowing Anne decade that's just ended, I'm calling this one the you can stop poking holes in my thinking anytime now decade. I'll close by mentioning that the reason I read a draft of Anne's book last summer was because she asked me if I'd be willing to write an endorsement. I said yes, but kind of sort of regretted agreeing to do that almost immediately. I found it a really accomplishment because it is a remarkable accomplishment. The task was difficult because I was really, really challenged. It's a book that forced me to think, and I don't like to do that around matters where I think I have it figured out. So thank you, Anne, for that press. And as I said, let's together call this decade You Can Stop Poking Holes in My Thinking Anytime Now. Over to you.
Oh my goodness. Thank you, Brent. That's quite astonishing. I don't really know what to do with myself. I'm mentally at the moment crawling under the table and pulling the tablecloth down so nobody can see me. But I guess I haven't got that option. So moving right.
Then it worked because I wanted you to put, I wanted to put you in sort of the same place I felt I had been put in. So awesomeness.
I hope one day I'll be invited to do something similar for Brent's next book when it comes out, because I could do something similar.
You're on.
I'm going to hand over to Michael and Helen. Michael Rice and Helen Lees are the series editors for this remarkable series of books that Palgrave have published on alternatives in education. So over to you.
I think I'm going first, Anne. Welcome to me into your fantastic launch. And to Michael. Michael, are you there?
Yep, I'm here, Helen.
Oh, fantastic. So is that right, Michael? I'll just say something about the series first for a few minutes and then over to you.
Perfect.
Okay, great. Well, this series was born of a desire for there to be a formal space for what is emerging, which we see in Anne's book as the outcome, the culmination, the product of wisdom. The wisdom of, it's not a new kind of thinking, but it's a kind of thinking which now is standing up for its humanity and for the place and the right of care in education. Michael and I have created this series to allow voices like Anne's to speak, and that's very appropriate because what the authors in the series are all doing, all brilliantly, is they are speaking up for students being able to speak and for educators having voice. So if you look at the blurb or the explanation of the series, the word voice appears over and over again, which is the key and the core of the philosophy underpinning that series. So the issue there to do with voice is that alternative voices, or voices that speak differently and speak for, like I say, it's not new thinking. People have been thinking this, you know, forever. It's just that a certain hegemonic way of doing things, systematized. I don't want to be too blunt and brutal in that respect, because it needs subtlety. But it's a way of thinking about education that desires differently from a sense of force. And so what we have in Anne's book is a voice that speaks up for this in the domain of maths. And frankly, I think given how wonderful that project is, we would rather like it if somebody would now come forward with one for reading and writing. So it's an incredibly important book. We're very honored to have it in the series. And I think, if there are any questions to Michael and I, or if you're interested, if you're listening in this launch and you're interested in publishing in the series, then you should certainly get in touch with us, because if you're here in this space, you're the kind of people who the series are very interested to speak with and talk to. And, you know, I personally would just like to thank Anne for publishing with us, because it's incredibly important to have her book in the world. Over to you, Michael.
Can I say, first of all, I am genuinely delighted to be here. It is one of the few advantages about meetings by Zoom that for book launches, one can, of course, get people from different countries and different time zones much more easily than was ever the case when they were only face to face. I'm a science educator. My doctorate and postdoc were in biology, but they were in mathematical biology. So when I trained to be a teacher, I did what you could do in those days, a sort of minor. My major was science education, my minor was maths education, and I was taught by Alan Bishop and Ken Ruthven. We were a pretty good pairing to get one going. One of the things I learned very rapidly from the two of them was that I couldn't be a real maths educator, because it's very, very different to being a science educator. I won't go into an academic lecture now. It's partly to do with the nature of knowledge, I think, in the two subjects, and the way that one therefore enables students learning to build up an appreciation of the subject. But I've always genuinely, therefore, retained great admiration for mathematics education. And there are quite a few of you here whom I don't know personally, because many of you are in the maths education world, but whose names I know. And one of the things I learned very rapidly was that mathematics education, when I trained to be a teacher, which was a long time ago, did a better job than science education was doing at that time in connecting with what I would regard as some of the more interesting areas of education. Some of you will know very well that Alan Bishop was especially interested in what's often referred to as ethno-mathematics. And it's taken science education a while to begin to catch up seriously with that. One of my colleagues who I see is on the call, Melissa Rodd, is one of a number of people, Yvette Solomon and others, who have worked at exploring seriously human relationships within the context of mathematics education, something that science education has completely failed to do so far. And then we come to Anne and her book. And I've known Anne slightly, but not deeply well, but slightly, for sort of 10-ish, 15 years or so. And Helen and I were absolutely delighted when she agreed to write this book, because this is actually an incredibly enjoyable series to be involved as an editor. Helen is the real expert in alternative education, because it's one of her major fields, and I, in a sense, sit alongside her. But we interpret the phrase broadly. And if you do read Anne's book, if you haven't yet, and I really, really would encourage you to do so, and I don't often say this at book launches, having obviously read the books rather carefully in advance, it is actually a wonderful book, because parts of it are utterly rooted in the practicalities of conventional mathematics classrooms or classrooms where mathematics is taught. Others of it are much more exploratory and about mathematics in different spaces. And obviously, as the title suggests, there is a deep interest in what it is to be human running throughout the book. But the last thing I'll say, and I'm so glad when I read this, and I thought it would be the case, because as Anne writes at the beginning, in a way, this is a summation of 30 plus years of her professional life. There's an enormous amount here that is absolutely specifically about teaching mathematics better. So, Anne, thank you very much indeed. And I think everybody's much looking forward to what you're going to say.
Thank you very much. And I would like to suggest that all of you at some stage have a look at the series description that Michael and Helen have written as an introduction to their series, because it lifted my heart to read it. It gave me hope for the future of education in a time when many things that are happening in education seem to be closing things down and mechanizing what people are expected to do. But the introduction to that book opens up possibilities. For those of you who know the Journal for the Learning of Mathematics, the introduction to Michael and Helen's series is a bit like that. It's sort of, come on, you know, what do you really think? Sort of beckoning to writers. Anyway, this book started a long time ago in a conversation with Mike Askew, who's joined us from Johannesburg. And I can't remember the context of the conversation, but we began to talk about the importance of love in mathematics classrooms. And I think this was just about the time when I was leaving the classroom and coming into academia, but it might have been a bit after that. And I thought, well, one day I might write a book which is about love in mathematics classrooms. And I started to collect little bits of paper and little thoughts and articles that were about that and put them in a box file entitled Love on the Outside. And then about 2 or 3 years ago, I was having a bit of a clear out. And I looked at this box and I thought, I'm never going to write another book and I'm not going to write this book. So I chucked it all away. So it was quite surprising to have an invitation from Michael to write a book about mathematics education that fitted with this very humanistic view of what thinking about education should be, and to realize that this was the book that I'd effectively chucked in the recycling. But I think that was the right thing, because you know yourselves, you might have all kinds of bits of thinking that don't quite gel into something. When you come back to them a lot later and look at them with the kind of maturing that happens to cheese, that you go and wine, that you go away and you don't do anything to it for a while. And when you come back, it's immeasurably better. So I think that the book that I would ever have written wouldn't have been like the book that I actually have written. So it's thank you to two Mikes, really, Mike Askew and Michael Rice. So I better stop blethering and share my screen. Which isn't happening. Right, let me just talk to myself for a bit while I try to get this sorted out properly. Can you see a PowerPoint slide? Excellent.
We can, yep.
Organized properly. From the beginning. So can you now see a proper PowerPoint slide? Good. We're up and away then. I've been disorientated by Brent's talk. And I'll tell you why as we go through. What is this not? It is not a how to teach maths book. That's one of the reasons why it doesn't cost £14.99. It is not a COVID book, because this was a book that took me a long time to write and think about, and a long time to produce and to go through the publication process. So it was a lot of the work was done pre-COVID, and COVID lockdown enabled me to do the writing, but it's not about what happened in the COVID world. Much more importantly, this is not a book about what I've come to call cognitive control. It's not a book about how to control the cognition of mathematics in one's students, pupils, learners, whatever. Although some elements of that might come into it, but cognitive control is not my bag. And I'll say a little more about that later. It's not a book that tells teachers what to think and what to do. I thought it was a book about what teachers actually do when the care for the learning of mathematics is embedded in the real lives of learners. And that's how I would have described it. But I now realize from what Brent has said that it's a book in which readers have to work hard at the ideas. I don't think it's an easy read, even though I've written it accessibly, and I think that my writing is accessible. But I think the ideas need to be arranged and put together yourselves when you read it, because it's a book about my thinking and my growth of knowledge, and that might not be the same as your thinking and your growth of knowledge. And I think Brent has exemplified that in the way that he's talked about it. So I'm going to tell you what's in the chapters, and depending how the time goes, I might stop and elaborate a bit. But it seemed to me important to really think about the context in which people are teaching mathematics. And starting with a brief history of educational policy and provision in England, particularly, because I'm hoping the book will be read internationally. So it's quite important to have the English context, because everything I end up with is in the English context, although we do go to other places meanwhile. But the English context has been particularly a story of increased control, increased attempts to control teaching, and through that, increased attempts to control mathematics cognition. And I try to deal with that in a fair and reasonable manner. Although, you know, when Michael Gove started quoting Gramsci, it got a bit difficult. So I deal with that. And a contrast with a focus on testing, the testing of top-down expectations of mathematics learning, and a more holistic view that includes other aims, other forms of knowing, other aims of education. And I think that post-COVID, we have more of a sense now in the public domain of debate that there are other aims to education as well as the exam scores. That we have to be more caring. We have to understand more the process of healthy psychological and emotional and social development, as well as cognitive development. In chapter two, I pulled together some strands of thinking and writing that I've done for quite a while and that other people have done about what the aims of education might be and how mathematics schooling fits in with that and contributes to that. What are the purposes and aims? What's the nature of school mathematics? These are contested. The nature of school mathematics is contested. It's not a common curriculum that is fairly universal and international through which children march. There's other things that go on in school mathematics. What's entailed in learning? The malleability of learning capability and the roles of language all crop up in chapter two. Now, you could say that sounds a bit thin. It sounds as if she's treating them a little bit superficially. And you kind of have to, if you're writing a book about a complex world, you kind of have to do that. But I do give references about where I've gone to get the ideas that I'm pulling together. So it's also a portal to some core literature about these things. In chapter three, the cognitive work of learning mathematics, I've been interested for probably 20 years or more in what's been going on in the field of cognitive science. I've been disturbed by the way that cognitive science results that are perfectly valid within the field of cognitive science, that are descriptions of how cognition works, turn themselves into instructions for teaching, which it seems to me a big category error. But it also seemed important that because these ideas are sweeping across maths education and education more generally, that it was important to put something in a chapter that stated where I am in terms of understanding the role of cognitive science. But there are other forms of mathematical knowing. There are other forms of knowing anyway, and I might mention one of them later, but there are certainly other forms of mathematical knowing that do not come just from the cognitive control, that is the turning of cognitive science results into instructions for teaching. And then in chapter four, I elaborate that further. And the idea of care comes creeping in because I want to contrast the notion of cognitive control with something I've been calling cognitive care. And it's the care for learning, the care for the learning process. And that's what I was interested in. And that's what I was beginning to ask questions about. And where I go to find answers to questions about teaching is I go to the practice of teachers. And most of the rest of the book is about understanding the practice of teachers in various educational spaces. But in chapter four, we hit the idea of core head on, and in particular, the work of Nell Noddings, who is one of the great writers on care in education. And I develop further from her work and also from the work of Amy Hackenberg, who published a wonderful paper for the learning of mathematics on care. The care for mathematics, the care for learners and their communities, and the care for connecting these in the learning of mathematics. One of the things that has always bothered me about talking with teachers about care, and all teachers care, I'm not saying there are special teachers who care, but there are teachers who might care in special ways. Very often I see when care is talked about in schools or with teachers that the care is the social and emotional care, the looking after care, but the mathematics is of the cognitive control type. So the care is kind of preparing the learner to become more resilient, more accepting, more compliant, more amenable to the cognitive control that typifies the maths teaching. I haven't said it as well as that in the book. The trouble with writing a book, you package it up and you send it away, but your thoughts keep going. But that idea of, you know, I care about you so much that you really will eat your Brussels sprouts. It's that kind of thing. Rather than taking the Brussels sprouts and the child and saying, well, how can we make these Brussels sprouts, you know, whatever it is. But that's probably not a very good analogy, but it's that kind of thing. So there's then this chapter that I think some people might find surprising, which is about maths education in indigenous communities. And this was where I did most of my learning and the foundation for my thinking of what follows. Because I was aware, as some of us are who work internationally in maths education, that there's a lot of work being done to try to teach mathematics in indigenous communities in such a way that retains the culture of the indigenous community, but also gives indigenous learners access to the kind of mathematics that enables them to be powerful in the world as it is. And Alan Bishop, that Michael referred to, is one of the initial thinkers about this. And so in chapter 6, I went into a place where I was reading and really enjoying reading and learning the work of people who teach in Aboriginal contexts in Australia, in Maori contexts in New Zealand, Sami people in Northern Finland and Norway, and in particular Native American communities. And the communities I was interested in were not where people have been taken out of their community and plunked into a European heritage context and made to fit, but education where people are in their communities, their cultural communities, and where the elders and the community provide a wraparound context within which the teaching and learning of mathematics takes place. Both heritage mathematics and also European heritage mathematics, and where those can be combined and intertwined. Why did I go there if I wanted to think about mathematics teaching in the school across the road from me? Because of what something Corinne said in our pre-chat this morning, it's extraordinary circumstances promote thinking. And she was talking about the current circumstances of post-COVID. But actually, I picked up that phrase and wrote it down. I thought, that's what I was thinking. If you go to a place where the entire culture is alien for the person who's gone in to teach maths, that is an extraordinary circumstance. And that should promote thinking rather than the kind of colonial view of imposing European heritage maths on everybody. So in that chapter, I learnt a number of really interesting things. The ways of listening that Brent talked about, the phrase listening to learners, it's a very important one, became quite revealing. There's one writer, Lisa Looney Borden, who discovered that the children in the community where she was teaching really had no static views of objects. Their language didn't give them a static view of an object. The things that in English are nouns tend to be verbs. So a cube, for instance, to describe a cube, you would say it sits still. You would talk about the behavior of the object rather than naming it and categorizing it according to some other categories. Now it strikes me that that's really important in mathematics. What we're interested in is what the objects that we think of as objects, and in English we talk about as objects, what they do is jolly important. how do you understand functions if you want to name them and classify them without thinking about what does a function do? And that struck me as a very important idea. And there were other ideas that came from other contexts in that chapter. I knew when I got to this chapter, I'd get a bit hooked up because there was something else that happened at that conference where Brent and I met, which was a presentation from an Aboriginal teaching assistant who had set up maths camps for the children in the schools where she was working. And one of the important things in the maths camps was using the idea of yarning. And this is a word I use in the book. Yarning is sitting around at the end of the day, having a good old natter about what's happened during the day, both physically and socially, but also in your mind. And this idea of yarning, what's in your mind, what's happened in the day, crops up again in some of the other educational spaces that I looked at. Now, a very strange thing happened to me while I was writing this chapter was that I began to find myself on several occasions. I hope this doesn't sound too colonial. But understanding different ways of knowing from different cultures in a way that I was inside them rather than just reading about them. And there were several moments while I was writing this chapter when that happened. And one of the most extraordinary ones was when I dreamt a name. And I dreamt a name, and when I woke up, I remembered this name, and I had no idea who it was. And I did lots and lots and lots of searching, and I couldn't find who this person was. And I could have just thought that was a dream and gone away, but I persisted. And I found a teacher in a school near Sydney who taught in a school that was in a European context, but had many, many Indigenous children in the school and an Aboriginal head teacher. And that school forms the end part of chapter 6 and provides a bridge to the more English educational spaces that I wanted to get to. And one of the wonderful things about this school is how, despite being in a European context, having many European heritage children in it, they structure things in such a way that the children from the Indigenous communities can live and learn within their cultural community, within their culture. Even mathematics. And that was the most wonderful experience. And that made real for me the importance of looking at the Indigenous communities, where the teaching is done within the nest of the community. So from that chapter, I learned the importance of alternative ways of seeing, the importance of using a range of materials. You know, some of these things you know, but I learned it anew. Big questions about relevance. One First Nation educator, Narcissus Blood, talks about people throwing in a feather and a bead and to shut them up. Really that kind of very superficial and patronizing approach to relevance. The importance of the shared task. The forest does not reject me, was a phrase which emerged. The importance of food and nutrition and yarning around the whole business of care for learning. And a respect for learners' knowledge and learners' thinking. And the role that a supportive community can play. For teachers, listening and taking account of what you hear. So listening to and acting flexibly as a result of what you hear. So then I go to chapter 7, which is perhaps more familiar, some alternative educational spaces in England where I could find cognitive care for mathematics, this care for the learning of mathematics that embraces the learner and the maths and the learning of mathematics. And this will surprise you. It's not just about going to places that are overtly cognitively caring. One of the places I go to, sixth form maths classes in a very expensive, ancient, what we call public school in England. That's one extreme example, a faith-based independent school, a therapeutic school, forest school, homeschooling, but not a kind of, you know, all homeschooling is different. So two particular examples of homeschooling. And I went there not to say this is how things should be, but to find out more about what it is when it's happening. Again, you have prioritizing listening, you have adapting teaching, you have the incorporation of the emotional and social self into learning. You have engagement with community of some kind. You have tasks that allow choice and support meaning making. Allow choice? This is not about controlling everything. This is about enabling the learner to become someone who can choose. And teachers being alongside learners and supporting the abstract reasoning. So not thinking, oh, some children can't think in the abstract, but supporting abstract reasoning through communication. Now that word alongside becomes really important. Teachers being alongside learners. And it could be sitting next to a learner and working on the same piece of paper on some mathematics. It could be being alongside in an attention way. One teacher that I use in the book, I saw a video of him in a classroom, and he was standing with the learners facing the same way as them. And that struck me as not usual. It should be, and it could be, but it's not usual. So this idea of being alongside learners seemed to be important. And I'm not saying that these can only exist in educational spaces that are specially set up to do so, because in chapter 8, I try to bring this all together and talk about care, these qualities of care in publicly funded mathematics education. Is it possible to do even now, when things are sometimes quite difficult? So chapter 8 is the really important chapter where you can read it and you can think, oh, I could do that. It's like that line in Chorus Line. It's so important. I could do that. Sometimes you only know what you could do by seeing somebody else do it and thinking, I could do that. And this is why getting into other people's classrooms is such a privilege and so important. I'll just let you read this. And one of the things that I found in every context that I looked at was that care included allowing the responsibility and control of the mathematical ideas to flow between the teachers and the students. So that would be something which, if I see it in a classroom going on, I would know that there was care for the learning of mathematics. thinking in terms of teacher-student contracts, not talking about formal contracts, but the climate that develops in a classroom, what characterizes the climate of learning in the classroom. Trust, two-way trust. The learners trust the teacher to listen to them, to understand them, to try to understand them. The teacher trusts the learners to do the learning. We're a learning organism. No, we're never not learning. There we go. Well, every complex idea can be reduced to a diagram. It doesn't really touch the edges. So I urge you not to take this diagram away and say this is what Anne's talking about. But I am a very geometrically minded person and I do need diagrams. So I do construct this diagram in the book. I build it up gradually. And the bit that the book, I hope, is about is that sort of shaded bit where the care for mathematics and the care for learner overlap, that bit. So these are not two separate things that have to be married up within a 50-minute lesson, neatly tidied up. This is an overlap in which all the real stuff is happening in that shaded area. And it's influenced by the personal lives of learners, and it's influenced by the everyday outside mathematical lives within which learners live, which could be, in our country, everybody's got to do long division by the age of 11. That's an everyday outside mathematical feature of life in this country at the moment. It's not the same as the care for mathematics, but it influences what goes on. So there is a diagram, and that's the diagram. So to summarize, I said we'd finish round about an hour, so I'm getting there. This is a list that you can take away and think about. These are the sorts of things that are going on in mainstream maths classrooms, that are going on in mainstream maths classrooms, that demonstrate that there is cognitive care going on. Knowledge of students, mathematical questioning, knowledge of the conceptual connections of mathematics, selecting, designing, and adapting tasks from the learners' perspectives. Use of tools, of course, mutual trust, listening, responsive interaction, both sides initiating interaction, both sides being responsive, yarning, time to chew over what's been done, the shifts of responsibility between the teacher and the learner. All the teachers that I came across, of course, were involved in continual professional learning. That's how I knew about them. So I'm not saying this is a necessary thing. It's just that that's what all the teachers had, because that was how I networked to find these teachers. And there's something interesting about autonomy. The teacher and the learner seem to be able to exercise autonomy when cognitive care is the driver in mainstream mathematics. And finally, being alongside each other. So I think we're opening chat now if there are any questions. I know I said it would be an hour and we're just on the hour. So if people want to drift away, that's fine. But I'll be here a bit longer, and I can answer questions. I'm hoping John will put up the discount thing again.
The chat is now open, and the discount is in the chat.
Thank you. So, questions, comments? Thank you, Becky. Do have a look at the series. It's there's some really interesting stuff there. And like I say, the series introduction should lift hearts. Lift hearts. Rhiannon, I think that you need to contact Rebecca Wide to ask about that, because that's not my decision about the question about reviewing.
Question from Michael. Anne? Are you now more or less optimistic about mathematics education than when you started your career?
Well, when I started my career, I was very optimistic about mathematics education, because there was much more freedom about what you could do, what you felt you could do in classrooms. What I learned as my career progressed was that you make your own freedom. You look at the constraints that you're working in, and you say to yourself, how can I work within these constraints in order to become a better teacher and to become a more of a listening teacher? So I go up and down in terms of how I feel about maths education more generally. One of the interesting things that has happened as a result of the superficial introduction of cognitive science into teaching is that a lot of teachers are thinking in much more detail about what they ask learners to do. And that is a good thing. But one of the things that worries me is the loss of the experience of teachers like Mike Ollerton and Helen Williams and so on, the experience of working in more, in ways in which the learner's response to the task is the main thing. It's not something that happens partway through and then the teacher thinks, right, I'll adapt and we'll go off in a different direction. It's something that happens from the beginning. And it would be sad if that got lost. John, can you point me to some other... I'm a bit wobbly, as I often am after I've done a talk. Some other questions.
But Michael observes that you are occupying a good existentialist position, because in this phrase, you make your own freedom.
Sorry?
Which is something we've both promoted, I think. Yes. Lynn McClure, do you think it's possible to write a curriculum that would embody cognitive care, or is this a layer of teacher professional development that has to be additional?
Okay.
I think it's something, I don't think you can write it into a curriculum, because you'd be writing about how to be a human, and that's ridiculous. Where the gap is how can I be a fully rounded human and become more of a fully rounded human through the teaching of mathematics, and ditto my learners, how can they become well-rounded, well-developed people through the learning of mathematics? And that's missing when there's a mechanistic view of teaching and testing around. And I think that, it's very sad that so many teachers leave the profession, and so many teachers feel that they're going to leave the profession, because I think that means that there is a mismatch between what being a teacher is like for them and what they want to be as people. And I think there needs to be work done there. It's professional development doesn't stop. I mean, I'm still learning all the time, even though it's quite frustrating when you're retired because you haven't got a group of people to work with all the time on new ideas and thoughts and perspectives. So it's something about being fully human in the educational space in which you find yourself. And I'm not talking about therapy. I'm talking about how do you find ways of teaching mathematics that build on what brought you to mathematics and what brought you to teaching, and keep those things like that rather than separating them out.
Jennifer Golding observes, I think there needs also to be care for mathematics teachers as people, and teachers and mathematicians within the system itself.
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. Hello, I hadn't seen you there. Yes, I think you're right. And I put a little bit about that towards the end of the book. There are things about teacher autonomy that are interesting that somebody could write more about. Does a teacher have to take the autonomy? And how brave do you have to be to do that? One or two of the teachers that I write about are working in contexts where they have autonomy, significant autonomy. Others are working in contexts where there's a sort of a team autonomy. One or two are working in contexts where they don't feel they have autonomy, but they bravely close the classroom door and get on with doing things the way that they feel much more comfortable about. But it does take a bit of courage, or quite a lot of courage. I would quite like there to be a way where teachers who feel that they need to be deeply courageous to teach in a more holistic way, but who don't have that support in their school, should be able to be together as a kind of conscientious objection type group. And obviously professional associations can provide some of that. But I'm thinking more about small communities of say 6 or 7 teachers who can talk to each other, not on Twitter, not on Instagram, but just among themselves about keeping the flame alive.
There's a long message from Tess, which I've replied to, about making use of some of these ideas in teaching East Timorese community in Oxford here. There's a question from Claire Christie. The idea of cognitive care feels hard to object to. Sorry if you said it, but my mind is flooded as always when you talk. But what do you see as the biggest barriers to cognitive care? And John Gale asks, what would a school that had the promotion of care and education as its central tenet look like? That book by the head teacher that you've got comes to my mind.
Okay. I want to tell you about this book. This is a book by James Hanscom. It's called A School Built on Ethos. And it's the person who ended up finding himself as the head teacher of a Harris Westminster sixth form specialist math school, very well funded. Children are taken from disadvantaged backgrounds all over London if they've shown some confidence in maths, and are brought to this school for a free, very maths and science, cognitive science focused education. But James Hanscom is deeper than that and broader than that. And he wants it to be a much more holistic educational experience than that description I've just given you. And it's a lovely book, and it's a lot cheaper than mine. But just go back. There was the question about barrier, but biggest barriers. Biggest barriers are being given a lesson plan that you have to go through, a lesson script that you feel you have to stick to, rather than an outline of how a concept might develop through a series of tasks that gives you some freedom to respond to what actually happens with children. Second biggest barrier is, I'm afraid, teachers' knowledge of the conceptual links in mathematics, sometimes very deep conceptual links in mathematics, so that they don't necessarily have those links ready and available to them to use in their planning and their teaching in the moment. Teacher knowledge, I wouldn't describe it as a barrier, because that's horrible. That sounds like you're blaming the teachers. But there's something about that those kinds of conceptual connections that are necessary to have in your repertoire. But the barrier is not feeling that you're allowed to yarn, not feeling that you're allowed to respond to what you hear when you listen to learners. Those are the biggest barriers. The care, what was John Gale's question?
What would a school that had the promotion of care in education as its central tenet, look like?
Mm-hmm. Whew. I think I've been very fortunate to teach in at least one school that did have that. But the care overwhelmed the cognitive responsibility of schooling. And there's got to be some kind of a balance. One of the schools I write about in the book is a therapeutic school, which is an independent school, but it's children who are publicly funded go to that school. It's a residential school. And care, in the most complex and deepest sense, is the main idea behind the existence of that school. But the actual subject teaching is normalized, but within that huge wraparound care situation. But because the children are going to go back into mainstream and into the home environment, which was very fractured for them, there has to be a combination of the emotional and psychological development and the cognitive development, which would be expected, that enables them to fit in with other people. And the staff student ratio is something like, it is right, staff to student, something like 4-1, including all the residential staff and the support staff and teaching assistants and the qualified teachers and everything. So that would be an extreme. But it's, John, you know that this is really a very complicated question to answer. But I think that you would enjoy James Hanscom's book, because it would give you some insight into how that can be done in the sort of educational contexts that you are quite familiar with.
There are a couple of observations, two by Lorinda, one by Rhiannon, at least one by Rhiannon, which are quite long and are offering sort of parallel situations that are worth looking at. In terms of questions, Sarah Richards asks, do we need to expand our ideas about what it means to be human? And Helen Lees asks, I think it's related, has writing this book developed your thinking?
It's easiest to answer Helen's, really. Oh, absolutely. It's developed my thinking. And I hoped when I finished the book that I was more articulate than I was when I started. But I have realized since having done several presentations about it that I'm not. And Brent has also given me some ideas for ways to, you know, what he sees in it that I hadn't said. I've now learned that they're in there, but that I hadn't said them. And the reason I hadn't said them was that I hadn't become aware of that particular way of putting ideas together. And of course, you know, when people have talked about other places to find these things, of course, nothing that I'm saying is new. There's nothing new. What I hope is new is the putting together of it in this particular way at this particular time. And maybe, because I know already that some people have found the idea of cognitive control and versus cognitive care quite a useful way to encapsulate what they think is a tension that's going on for them at the moment. So, so I think it's a contribution to something that a lot of us know in our guts, even if we haven't known it in our heads or in our mouths.
Dan asks, I have heard you talk about chapter 6 a few times, Anne, and I am wondering what is unfinished for you related to it, if anything?
One of the things that I'm left with after writing chapter 6, as well as this more trust about instinct and intuition and thinking about those, the roles of those in what we do, is this sense of a lot of children not being in a wraparound community that gets engaged with the teaching and learning of mathematics in the ways that some of the communities in chapter 6 do. And I think it's going to be quite interesting to see how enforced homeschooling might have influenced that. There's already been a very interesting paper in the journal Prospect from somebody who took the homeschooling really seriously and was really quite shocked at what children were being asked to do in mathematics and in literacy. So it'd be interesting to see if there's going to be some way that community can engage more with schools in a way that supports cognitive care. But actually, I'll modify that. Feeding children is more important. I think we've gone way past the hour.
Okay. Katie has asked if you could put in the chat the title of the ethics book. I think it's the one that she was looking for. And she also asks, will the paperback be cheaper?
The paperback is going to be cheaper. Yeah. I take no responsibility for the price. I think I've often asked myself, if I knew when I started what the price was going to end up being, would I have written the book? And I don't know the answer to that. It's an academic book, and it's gone through layers of academic stuff, and that's what the price ends up being. The School Built on Ethos is James Holcomb's book.
Chris White has put it in the chat. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. Will there be a Kindle edition?
There is an ebook. I think did you put that up in the chat that there's an ebook and
Rachel has just put that in. Yeah.
Thank you. Gosh, isn't chat wonderful? Yeah.
So the only Amico has asked, is care in mathematics education about showing respect for a multicultural perspective to mathematical learning?
No, those are not the same thing, but of course care includes that. But that's not the whole of it, because it's everybody's learning from any cultural background. But I think the phrase multicultural has many, many meanings, and we'd have to have a longer conversation about what we were meaning by that. I wouldn't want to equate the two, but I think there is probably a huge overlap. But in the end, you may think it unfortunate, in the end, it's European, what I've called EHSM, European Heritage School Mathematics, that children have to learn and pass exams in order to get the social passports and the employment passports into the further study and employment opportunity. So
I think
that's the world that we're in.
So finally, Helen has reminded us that sometimes Palgrave have sales. You could look out for them by following Palgrave on Twitter to get updates, perhaps.
That's useful to know. Thank you. And of course, if you're associated with a library, get the book in the library. And sometimes, I think there's something that Springer do, who are the producers of the book, that if the book is in the library, then you can get an e-version much, much cheaper for yourself. Corinne, you're nodding. Do you know more about that than I do?
I was just going to say, I'm just about to ask Stirling University to buy the book. And what they tend to do now is to buy an online version of new things where you can argue that it's important for lots of different students.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much for coming. You warm my heart. Did you hear me? Yes, warm my heart. I don't know if Brent is still with us. He's probably fallen asleep. But thanks again to Brent, and thanks again to Michael and Helen for coming, and for Becky for giving the information and so on. And enjoy the rest of the day.